reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. We're delighted to welcome to our session today students from Maquanago High School. Would they please stand? Good. Well, we had your colleagues earlier today at the first session. You may be seated. The students are here with a national prize-winning program called Caught with Class that's sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. The students have received materials about this case and may have had people talk with them about it. And then as a part of this program, the students will meet with their colleagues that attended the 9:45 session and meet with a justice of the court. So we've met you. Let us introduce the justices to you. I'm going to start on my far right with Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice John Wilcox, and he is the justice with whom you will meet, and everybody is invited to attend. There will be discussion of the procedures of the court, not the substance of the case. And seated next to Justice John Wilcox is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. With those introductions made, I'll call the second case, 01-3303-CR, State v. John Norman. Appearing for the defendant, John Norman, is Angela Conrad Kaczelski. Attorney Kaczelski, you have 25 minutes and 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Angela Kaczelski, and I represent the petitioner, John Norman. The petitioner's right of confrontation was violated by the admission of the preliminary hearing testimony of Ms. Park at the trial. Ms. Park's testimony at the preliminary hearing did not fulfill the confrontation clause. The first question is whether or not the evidence fits within a recognized hearsay exception, and it does under 908 sub 045 sub 1. It fits within the former testimony exception. We must then look to whether or not it satisfies the confrontation clause. There are two requirements that must be met before the confrontation clause can be satisfied, and the first is that the witness must be unavailable. It was argued at the trial court very briefly that this witness, that the state had not made a good faith effort to secure Ms. Park's presence at the trial. They submitted an affidavit stating that she was ill and that she couldn't travel from Illinois to northern Wisconsin. I am not conceding unavailability, but absent any questions, I will rely with what's been stated in the briefs regarding unavailability. The second requirement that this court must look at is whether or not the evidence bears some indicia of reliability. And if it falls within a firmly rooted hearsay exception, then reliability can be inferred. And again, here we have a firmly rooted hearsay exception. So reliability can be inferred, but it is not automatic. The trial court of the court must...
Counsel, just let me interrupt you. Were you here for the argument we just had on...
Yes, I was.
Similar but not the same issue. Thank you.
Go ahead. I was. The court must look at the case to determine if there are unusual circumstances which may warrant exclusion of the evidence, and we are arguing that this is such a case. The cross-examination at the preliminary hearing was minimal. Defense counsel asked only three questions. Ms. Park was the only witness who could testify regarding count number three, which was one of the fraud counts. There was no other evidence that could be brought in that could attack her credibility. I'm aware that there are a long line of cases in the state of Wisconsin which allow preliminary hearing testimony to be admitted at a trial when the witness is unavailable, but again, it is not automatic. And at a preliminary hearing, as this court has been discussing in the last argument, plausibility is the issue. Plausibility of the charges against the defendant. There are a number of cases that have held that credibility is not an issue at a preliminary hearing. Defense counsel cannot attack a witness's credibility at a preliminary hearing and cannot attempt to impeach the witness for bias or to bring in prior inconsistent statements. Now, the United States Supreme Court has held that the right of confrontation does include the right to impeach a witness for bias and the right to confront a witness with prior inconsistent statements. At a preliminary hearing, defense counsel or the defendant is not given that right. And therefore, a preliminary hearing testimony should not be admitted and does not comport with confrontation and should not be admitted at the trial.
Well, it should not be admitted when bias, prior inconsistent statements, or credibility are an issue.
That's correct.
Okay. How are they at issue here?
Barbara Park was the only witness against John Norman on count three. And as I said, there were only three questions on cross-examination of Ms. Park. There were issues, there could have been issues regarding this receipt that she was shown where she claimed it had her name signed and she claimed it was not her signature. There were other issues as to whether or not she had dealt only with a co-actor, Daniel Kremeyer, or not with Mr. Norman. And also, and I think most telling, at the time of trial, trial counsel objected to the admission of the statement and argued that he did not believe he had a full and fair opportunity for cross at the preliminary hearing, and that he had not had the discovery at that time before the preliminary hearing and would not have been able to cross-examine her.
Well, see, your case, it seems to me, is quite different from the last case. Mm-hmm. Because in the last case, we're dealing with accusatory-type statements of a witness who can't appear. And it's hearsay that just absolutely damns the defendant. It says, he said he killed him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here, she's not saying that at all. She doesn't know the defendant. She doesn't know what he did. All she knows is that she traded in a boat. I think this is the count, right?
She traded
in a $2,500 boat and only had to pay $11 in exchange for the other boat. Now, that to me seems to be very peripheral-type testimony and certainly not accusatory as to the defendant. Why? How does that implicate bias, prior inconsistent statements, or go to the credibility?
Mm-hmm. Well, Ms. Parks, again, was the only witness that could testify about this fraudulent writing. Mr. Norman was charged with fraudulent writing by an employee. And as such, she was the only person who could look at that receipt and who could say, I didn't sign this, and my name is on the receipt, but it's not my signature, and I did not pay the $1,000 that the receipt says I did. She was the only witness that could say that. And that's why her testimony.
Did she say that at the prelim?
She did, but she was not cross-examined as to her signature, and she was not. There was only three questions, and they were related to if she had worked with Daniel Kremeyer and not John Norman, and why she had traded in the boat. There was nothing substantive in the cross-examination.
Would it make any difference if there were? Excuse me.
Sorry, yes.
Would it make any difference if there were 10 questions, but they were any different than the three?
I anticipated a question about number of questions. I don't believe it would have made a difference. In the preliminary hearing, because plausibility is the only issue and one can never get into credibility under our case law, it's my argument that the preliminary hearing testimony can never comport with the confrontation rights that are set forth in Davis versus Alaska and Jenks versus United States. Because if credibility is an issue in the case, you can never attack that credibility at the preliminary hearing. So it wouldn't matter if it's three questions, five questions, 10 questions. Under our case law, defense counsel cannot attack that credibility, and therefore that former testimony should not be admissible at the trial.
Well, how does that square with the Tomlinson case?
Mm-hmm. I'm asking this court, and I believe that this court can, the court can overrule the Tomlinson case. The court could also find that because preliminary hearing when credibility is an issue, because that preliminary hearing testimony does not comport with the confrontation clause, they could find that that's an unusual circumstance under Bauer, and that would mean if there was credibility at issue, that a preliminary hearing testimony would then be an unusual circumstance and would not be admissible at the trial. Or the court could also reexamine the line of cases which prohibits impeachment at a preliminary hearing. I think that would be burdensome on the courts, and I would suggest that either finding it's an unusual circumstance or overruling Bauer and Tomlinson would be the correct.
So your position is that at a preliminary, we have to change our rules and allow a credibility attack, or we're potentially saying you can't use the preliminary because credibility can't be attacked.
That's correct. Again, I think the first, changing the rules at the preliminary hearing may be burdensome to trial courts, and that may not be what this court would want to do. It would also
How would the U.S. Supreme Court rule on your proposed rule of law, or have they?
The U.S. Supreme Court has set forth the various requirements to meet the Confrontation Clause. They have ruled generally that preliminary hearing testimony can come in if you can show that there's been sufficient cross-examination. Our argument is that in our state, because plausibility is the only issue at the preliminary hearing, that can't comport with the Confrontation Clause. I realize that there's a line of cases that says it can come in.
Well, that's why I was saying that we have Bauer, we have Tomlinson, and what you're saying is that we should simply overrule those cases.
You can either overrule those cases or you can declare that this is an unusual circumstance when you have preliminary hearing testimony and then it doesn't automatically come in.
Counsel, you seem to be saying two things. It doesn't automatically come in, mm-hmm. and then you're saying it doesn't come in. And obviously there's a difference.
Yes.
I heard you earlier suggesting that there is a bright line rule that your position is advocating, that preliminary hearing testimony, because it addresses plausibility rather than credibility, mm-hmm. is not admissible. Is that your position? Always is not admissible. Is that your position?
That is my position.
And yet what do you do with the reality of, although prelims are for plausibility rather than credibility, you can have a transcript that can go on, let me give you a hypothetical, for hours cross-examining on credibility, and as long as there's no objection, the judge will just let it continue. Mm-hmm. And so you have a full transcript that's thoroughly exhausted the issue of credibility. Is your bright line rule, mm-hmm. does your bright line rule still apply in that hypothetical?
I would assert it does, but I could understand where the court may then look at that and address and find that credibility has been challenged. But again, under the case law, credibility is not an issue. So defense counsel who is aware of the case law should not attempt to impeach a witness for credibility at the preliminary hearing.
But a defense attorney may find it advantageous to try to get as much out of the prelim mm-hmm. as he or she can and to push the envelope as much as he or she can in the interest of their client.
I think this court could deal with that sort of situation where in some cases you have credibility attacked and other cases you don't by finding that if credibility is not attacked, that causes or presents an unusual circumstance, and then under Bauer it would be excluded.
So your bright line isn't so bright line, huh? If it is attacked, then it wouldn't be an unusual circumstance under Bauer?
My position is it should be a bright line rule, but I can understand that this court may not want to set a bright line rule, and then you could take the unusual circumstances and extend them to the preliminary hearing where credibility is not attacked, as the case law says it should not be.
You had a discovery request, mm-hmm. and in responding to that, the state provided a statement of Barbara Park.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any prior inconsistent statement in that statement?
There was not. However, I do believe, and I was not trial counsel, but I do believe from the record and from what I have looked at, she could have been questioned, and this is speculation, she could have been questioned more as to the signature that was purported to be hers on this receipt and whether or not this issue of was it Dan Kramer or John Norman who was actually the person who had signed this receipt and who had made the false writing on the receipt. There was some issue that was not able to be
Well, but those documents, the three documents, didn't come in or were not available as a result of discovery. Were they not attached to the complaint?
Yes.
So that at the time of the cross-examination, those documents were not only available then, they had been available before then.
That's correct. Ms. Park testified that the document was, yes, available. The fact that Ms. Park had never actually seen this second document that the state presented that came from Schroeder Marine showing the signature of hers, She testified at the preliminary hearing she had never seen that before and that that wasn't her handwriting. Defense counsel did not go into that, and that would have been a place to challenge her credibility at the trial.
Well, on the document that talks about the $1,000, mm-hmm. her signature isn't on that at all.
There was a second document that she was shown where they asked her if that was her signature, and she said it was not. She had never seen that document before until the preliminary hearing.
With respect to the credibility of Barbara Park, I mean, is there anything that you could say to the court today other than a theoretical, you have to be able to test credibility. Mm-hmm. Is there anything specific that you could say, there was an issue here about credibility, and it was?
There's nothing specific other than the comments I've made already, factual comments that the trial counsel may have wanted to go into. The only thing I can turn to that's in the record is trial counsel's statement that he did not believe he had a full and fair opportunity for cross-examination because he didn't have all the discovery prior to the preliminary hearing. He didn't go ahead and ask a number of questions during the prelim in order to elicit objections, and he didn't make a further record regarding why he didn't believe he had been given an opportunity for full and fair cross-examination. But in light of the charges and in light of the fact that she was the only witness against Mr. Norman on that count, and that there was some question on whether or not Mr. Kramer had been involved, too, in some fraudulent writings or other people, I believe that would have been an area to attack her credibility.
$1,004.81 mm-hmm. that one document says she paid toward that little boat.
Yes.
I see on page 9 of your brief that John eventually paid $1,004.81 mm-hmm. to, I don't know how to pronounce that, Marine, for the boat.
Shorter Marine, yes.
I mean, doesn't that kind of eliminate any credibility about her testimony that she didn't pay it?
It's true. John Norman did testify and testified about the fact that he had paid that. However, Mr. Norman testified at the beginning of the defense case. After the court had already let in the preliminary hearing testimony, I can't say whether or not he would have made different decisions. Trial decisions are made as you're going through and things are being admitted. It may have impacted his decision, the fact that that statement came in. It may have impacted what he had testified to and how much about that count. So it's true that he did testify about it.
You make an argument about the importance of examining a witness for bias. Mm-hmm. Excellent argument. Is there any evidence in this record that Barbara Park was biased in as much as she testified she had never met Mr. Norman?
There is nothing in this record to show that she was biased, but I get, again, because I think it's a more general concept, because at the preliminary hearing, plausibility is the only issue, and you cannot attack bias. There's nothing in this record to show that she was biased, but I do not believe that that precludes our claim. I do think that this court can hold that under the Confrontation Clause, because there is a right at trial to confront your witnesses and to impeach a witness for bias or to impeach a witness with prior inconsistent statement, that because the preliminary hearing we're not allowed to bring that in, that preliminary hearing testimony doesn't comport with the Confrontation Clause. There is nothing in the record, though, regarding bias of Ms. Park.
Now, the state would indicate that there's really no issue of bias here. And therefore, theoretically, if you were right, this case does not present that issue. And that without that issue, you've got a standard preliminary hearing, which is ordinarily admitted. So what's your response to the state that it's not an issue because there's no issue. The only issue is intent as to the Parks document that Norman admitted he falsified Parks' purchase agreement, and that the only issue resolved with Parks and her vote was whether Shader, is it?
Shorter.
Knew of this, and that Parks had nothing to say about that.
It's true she had nothing to lend to whether or not Mr. Norman was the actual person who committed the fraudulent writings. And I have no specific information to say to this court, this is the bias that they would have, he would have cross-examined or could have cross-examined her on at trial. But again, it's the fact that at the preliminary hearing, you can't cross-examine a witness regarding credibility. It's that fact that does not comport with the Confrontation Clause. And while this may, I believe that this case does present facts that can support that finding because of the minimal cross-examination, because of the fact that trial counsel did not get into, and maybe he could have on some level, but he did not get into any of the issues regarding her signature, regarding John Norman, or things that would have impacted or could have impacted her credibility.
You're really asking for a per se rule here, aren't you, that because of the nature of a preliminary hearing in the state of Wisconsin, admission of that prelim transcript is always a violation of the Confrontation Clause. That's how I understand your argument. Is that wrong?
That is my first request, yes. But again, I understand that this court may not accept that, and that's why I offer the alternative that this court can find under Bauer a preliminary hearing testimony presents an unusual circumstance. That allows this court not to overturn Bauer or to set a per se rule, but allows this court to say at a preliminary hearing it presents an unusual circumstance, and if credibility is not allowed to be presented at the preliminary hearing, then it doesn't comport with confrontation.
But how do you deal with Tomlinson then? I mean, it's out there. It's a case written in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
I notice you didn't cite it. That's why either in your supplemental or in your...
Well, I think with Tomlinson... I believe that you would have to overrule Tomlinson in order to make this make the ruling that the preliminary hearing testimony wouldn't come in. I believe you would have to overrule Tomlinson. It wouldn't. My argument as to finding that it's an unusual circumstance would not allow the court to continue to keep the precedent of Tomlinson.
So your case is different from Tomlinson because of that they only asked three questions?
Yes, that's exactly right.
So your backup position is that it's a preliminary hearing may be a special circumstance under Bauer. It may be a circumstance when the defense is curtailed from exploring credibility. Do I understand that correctly or not?
That's correct.
Does that rule require an attempt by defense counsel at the preliminary hearing to ask those sorts of questions and an actual, objection sustained?
Yes, that's a good question. It's something I've thought about because in my case we don't have that. There were no objections to any of these statements. And I'm not sure if it should be required. It may present, it may be too burdensome on the preliminary hearing courts to have to go through every possible question and have an objection. I don't know the answer to that.
What if the defense attorney at the top of the hearing says, Judge, I'd like a continuing objection, I'd like the record to reflect that, I'd like to ask these questions. I know they're going to be objected to. I know those objections are going to be sustained, but I'd like to, note my position on this.
I think that would work, yes.
Well, you could probably provide that on a post-conviction hearing. Did you provide that here?
No, we didn't have a post-conviction hearing. We appealed directly to the Court of Appeals. You could also do it at a post-conviction hearing if you had trial counsel testify what he or she may have questioned.
But you don't have any of that here.
No, we don't. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kaczelski. Edwin J. Hughes, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, representing the State of Wisconsin. Mr.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Edwin Hughes on behalf of the State. Mr. Norman received a fair trial, and he has no legitimate basis for his appeal. The Court of Appeals correctly dismissed the appeal, affirmed the conviction, and the same result is compelled here. The court should decline the invitation to overrule Bauer and Tomlinson and the entire progeny of cases that have flowed from Bauer and from Ohio versus Roberts in 1980. No reason has been offered as to why that consistent line of decisions is wrong and is necessary to be overruled. The Supreme Court in Ohio versus Roberts said that no confrontation clause violation is presented in a situation where a witness is unavailable and hearsay statements are admitted into evidence which have sufficient indicia of reliability. And the court said as well that reliability can be inferred when, in a case in which the evidence sought to be offered falls within a firmly rooted hearsay exception and previous testimony hearsay exception is firmly rooted. The confrontation clause of the U.S. Constitution is the same or provides the same protections as that under state law. And so even if the court were to consider that, perhaps Bauer was wrongly decided, and as I say, no reason has been offered for that, I would think that Ohio versus Roberts stands as a barrier to even reach that issue. The secondary issue then is...
What was that case again that you just cited, the U.S. Supreme Court?
Ohio versus Roberts.
Okay. Did that case involve the denial of the ability to cross-examine as to credibility, bias, prior inconsistent statements, or the like?
No, there haven't been cases that have...
No, it said
no.
No. Okay.
There have not been cases that have specifically addressed that particular point. And in the cases, there have been discussion of the fact that cross-examination was provided. So that particular issue has not come up. Certainly in the Supreme Court, in the Supreme Court jurisprudence. And in this Court's cases, in the Court of Appeals cases, it's true that there has been discussion of the extent to which cross-examination was provided at the preliminary hearing, in the course of reaching the conclusion that the evidence could be admitted. There hasn't been any ruling certainly that cross-examination equivalent to that provided at trial must be provided at a preliminary hearing in order for the testimony to be permitted.
But looking at Tomlinson, and in Tomlinson, the court said first they look at unavailability. Then the court says we move to the second prong, whether the admitted evidence bears sufficient indicia of reliability, so it doesn't violate the right of confrontation. And this was a preliminary hearing issue. And then the court goes on to say, here, Coleman's preliminary hearing testimony clearly contains sufficient indicia of reliability. As the U.S. Supreme Court has noted in similar cases where preliminary hearing testimony was introduced, the testimony at the preliminary hearing was given under circumstances that closely approximated those at trial. The cite is to the Green U.S. Supreme Court case. Therefore, said the court, the evidence is sufficiently reliable to protect Tomlinson's confrontation rights. Then they went on and say it was given under oath. There was before a tribunal. That the setting was equipped to make a judicial record, represented by counsel, and that defense counsel, and then I'm reading additionally, Tomlinson's defense counsel had an opportunity to cross-examine Coleman at the preliminary hearing. During cross-examination, the defense attorney was able to elicit information helpful to Tomlinson's defense, including the fact that Coleman did not call the police after the incident, that Coleman did not see whether Tomlinson struck Phillips a third time because he'd been leaving the scene, that Coleman had been drinking. And here's the kicker line. Thus, we find Tomlinson's ability to cross-examine Coleman was meaningful. So, in Tomlinson, which is a 2002 case, and I don't know if there's any more recent, the court just did not say Ohio v. Roberts period. Didn't say preliminary hearings are okay in this state. No, they said preliminary hearings look okay, but we have to look and see whether in this particular preliminary hearing there were indicia of reliability, and then analyzed it in four paragraphs. Do you think that's the right approach?
Your Honor, I think in Tomlinson it was the right approach because there was no reason in that case for the court to conclude that there was any reliability problem. It's the position of the state that an unusual circumstance for Bauer cannot be a situation that is inherent in the preliminary hearing situation.
Let me try it differently. Then, is it the state's approach as to how we should be writing these opinions that we should say that in all preliminary hearings they're admissible and not violating confrontation?
No, I don't. I think there can be unusual circumstances.
Okay. They're generally admissible unless the court finds unusual circumstances, period.
Correct.
There are no unusual circumstances here, period.
In this case, there are no unusual circumstances,
right. So yes. Give me an example of what would be the unusual circumstances in Tomlinson, because that's not how we attack the issue in Tomlinson. In Tomlinson, and I think in the other cases, we looked to see if there were indicia of reliability, and there was no fuss in Tomlinson about credibility, and if there was, the defense attorney got at it.
The unusual circumstances that may conceivably be present are those which short-circuit the preliminary hearing procedure itself. And the ones that have been identified in other cases are where there's ineffective assistance of counsel provided to the defendant at the preliminary hearing, or there was another case, and I don't have the site, where the counsel for the defendant had a conflict of interest which prohibited him from aggressive cross-examination of the witness. But so there are situations in which the defendant does not get what he or she is entitled to at a preliminary hearing, which can create an unusual circumstance. But something which is inherent in the preliminary hearing procedure itself, that is a limitation on the ability to cross-examine with respect to credibility, could not be an unusual circumstance.
So you're saying, here's the hypothetical. I'm a defense attorney at a prelim, and I have the opportunity, it's my turn to cross-examine, and I say, Judge, I've got three pages of questions here, but they all go to credibility. I find this case all boils down to the credibility of this witness versus my client. And the only cases I have, the only questions I have on these three pages involve credibility. I'd like to start to ask them, Judge, can I start? Judge says, absolutely not. Plausibility, I won't let you get into credibility. You know the law here in this state council. That's the transcript before you. Is that an unusual circumstance?
No, it is not an unusual circumstance.
Tell me how that meets the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation.
Well, I think it's important to step back and say the question here isn't a comparison between this particular testimony and the testimony as it would be presented at trial. There's no question but this is the second best solution, which is only something that the question only comes up when the witness is not available for trial. So the first thing that has to be demonstrated is that the witness is, in fact, unavailable, and so you won't have the best situation, which is the person present in trial available for cross-examination.
Yeah, and I guess I meant implicit in my question that
right.
This goes on to trial, and the person's then not available, and they want to use the transcript from the prelim. So we have the issue of, number one, are you unavailable? And then you also, even if you meet unavailability in a hearsay exception, don't you have to look at confrontation?
Yes. And in that situation, the question is whether that all that the testimony at the preliminary hearing will come in at all or will it be entirely excluded. And in striking the balance, the question is, does it have sufficient indicia of reliability in order to allow the jury to consider that evidence? The Supreme Court has indicated that it does have sufficient indicia of reliability because it falls within a firmly rooted hearsay exception. Now, certainly that's a balancing test, but on balance, what the courts have determined is that we will allow the jury to consider that testimony because we think that given the other circumstances, the testimony is given under oath, there is cross-examination available with respect to perception and plausibility and the other aspects, and because the defendant has an opportunity to confront the witness personally at the hearing. Given those other indicia of reliability, on balance, the courts have said that testimony can be admitted. Now, there are certainly other ways in which defense counsel can bring out whatever credibility issues there may be at trial. There is other evidence that may be admitted. There is cross-examination of other witnesses which may get to that point. And indeed, there may be a credibility issue, but that is something that, as a practical matter, gets conveyed to the jury by whatever means it does. The actual cross-examination of the witness typically is not something that the witness is going to say, oh, yes, I see you're saying I have a bias here, and so, yes, my testimony perhaps can't be trusted. The questions that go to bias simply bring those points out for the jury to consider. And there are other ways in which that information can be conveyed at a trial. And so given all
it's easy to say there are other ways, and sometimes in cases there may be other ways. But other times it's a he said, she said. And there's no other witness to call. It all boils down to credibility. He said, she said. No other person they talked to about it an hour later to bring in and try to get, no present sense impression, no other hearsay, exception and testimony, no physical evidence. Do you believe her or do you believe him? So although there may be other things at trial might be applicable in some case, it's not in all cases. How do you address that?
Well, I address that by saying that the choice is whether the jury can consider that information with the inherent deficiencies that may be implicit in it, or whether that information has to be withheld from the jury by virtue of the confrontation clause.
Yeah, that's the question we
and
have.
And it's discretionary decision that a trial court can reach. And
it's discretionary, but when you have implication of a confrontation clause, you have a constitutional question, and we review that de novo.
Correct. So on balance, what the law has certainly indicated or implied, although not specifically held, when the particular issue is limitations on cross-examination, is that on balance that should come in. Now, that's certainly not this case, of course.
What's bothering me is the abyss between the lofty language that's attributable to what is meant by a confrontation right under the Sixth Amendment and what I perceive you're advancing. I'm looking at the Blinker's rule on evidence and dealing with the very issue of, confrontation right, preliminary hearing, hearsay. He advances this premise. The central concern of the Confrontation Clause is to ensure the reliability of the evidence against a criminal defendant by subjecting it to rigorous testing in the context of an adversary proceeding before the trier of fact. The word confront, according to Blinka, after all, means a clashing of forces or ideas, thus carrying with it the notion of adversariness under the Confrontation Clause. Okay, I can buy that. That's, to me, what I think maybe this constitutional right is all about. But you seem to be suggesting that, hey, judge, all of my questions, I'm telling the judge at the preliminary hearing, all of my questions deal with credibility because this case all boils down to credibility. And you're saying, The judge rightfully will deny that, and that opportunity is lost. Where is this rigorous stuff under the Constitution, this rigorous adversary process? It's just bothersome to me. Can you respond to me?
Yes. The argument that you're suggesting would hold that would exclude any hearsay testimony at a criminal trial.
Oh, I'm not advancing that at all.
But there is certainly no opportunity to cross-examine someone who's making an excited utterance that comes in. There's certainly no opportunity to cross-examine a hearsay declarant whose testimony comes in under an exception for statements for purposes of medical treatment. Any hearsay that comes in is second-best evidence. But on balance, courts have concluded that it has sufficient indicia of reliability to permit the jury to consider it with its deficiencies. And we trust the jury to be able to assess that information, that evidence, and not necessarily, you know, the fact that it was provided at the court doesn't mean that the jury's going to say, well, if witness X is said this in a preliminary hearing, it must be true. We allow them to trust it.
Isn't there arguably in the context that I advanced, where credibility is the only issue in the case, a difference between sufficient indicia of reliability under rules of evidence and the what's contemplated in terms of the rigorous adversarial process and reliability under the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment?
Justice, I can't deny there's a tension there between what, you know, the aspirational goal of the Confrontation Clause and the necessity in a trial to sometimes admit hearsay evidence or other evidence which is not tested by that sort of vigorous cross-examination, which all would agree would be preferable. It's a concession to the reality of the trial process that sometimes witnesses who have very important testimony to provide won't be available to testify. And if that's the situation, then the courts have to consider, well, what are we going to do here? Are we going to keep it out? Or are we going to let it in? And the way the law has developed is that we've got these hearsay exceptions and say if it falls within a firmly rooted hearsay exception, we are going to conclude on balance that the jury is entitled to consider that, and we will trust the jury to give that sort of evidence the sort of consideration that it merits under the circumstances.
But we do that. We do that because, for the most part, there's not been a prior opportunity to test. You use excited utterances, for example. When we're dealing with preliminary examination, we're dealing with an opportunity that has been denied.
There's an opportunity.
That's a pretty major distinction.
No, the temptation in these sorts of situations is to look back retroactively and say, had we known that the witness was not going to be available at trial, well, maybe at the preliminary hearing the judge should have let more, you know, if there was in fact a credibility issue, which, of course, going back to the Norman case, there isn't one. But if there were, then perhaps the judge should have been more lenient in allowing cross-examination testimony here. But what we're saying is, in the situations in which it arises, for one reason or another, the witness died, the witness has health problems, the witness is no longer available, which is something that whoever the proponent of the witness certainly does not hope for. So you've got a second-best situation unavoidably. And then you have to deal with what you have as a historical fact. You can't go back and provide the opportunity at that point. If you could, you certainly would. But
you wouldn't, because the rule here in the preliminary is you can't testify as to credibility. And I suggest to you the difference between excited utterance and the other examples you gave are those comments are not made for purposes of trial. They are not made within the trial for purposes of either convicting or not convicting. They are made at the time unrelated to the trial. The preliminary hearing is sworn testimony for purposes of the trial. And that raises a different issue as to reliability than the excited utterance. The whole point about the excited utterance is you're doing it thoughtlessly. so you have no motive, no time to plan. That's not true at the preliminary. So the real issue here is, seems to me, that the state says, per se, with one exception, you allow preliminary testimony. And the one exception is unusual circumstances. And those unusual circumstances cannot be inherent in the preliminary hearing.
That's right.
So suppose the court had, suppose the state had a rule that all hearsay is allowed in a preliminary hearing, which raises questions of reliability. That is not here, not within the rule, within exceptions, but all hearsay is permitted, or as a rule, no cross-examination at preliminary. Would that be okay?
Well,
no cross-examination is allowed at preliminary. The state puts in its evidence.
If there were no cross-examination available at all at preliminary hearings, we would have a different preliminary hearing concept, and the precedent that we're relying on here would no longer be applicable, I don't think. In that case, then the court, the state would not be arguing that precedent compels or suggests that that automatically would come in. The argument would be it would have to be an initial decision would have to be made whether that has sufficient indicia of reliability.
So and is it your position that the preliminary hearing has to be, as Green says, according to Tomlinson, given under circumstances that closely approximated those at trial?
Depending on how one defines closely approximated, certainly, yes.
Yes. That's why I'm asking you to define it. If you don't allow credibility, is that closely approximated to trial? That's really the issue.
Yes, and we're stating our conclusions and saying, of course, it sufficiently closely approximates conditions of trial to make it reliable enough to be admitted.
Counsel, but let's take a trial where the confrontation problem arises when the trial court unduly restricts the defendant's right to cross-examine the prosecution's witness, the main witness. So take my hypothetical that existed at the prelim and put it in the trial. I'm a trial attorney now. Trial's going on. I know this sounds a bit bizarre, but let me advance it as my hypothetical. Major witness at trial, and I say, Judge, I got 3 pages here. This is the heart of the case. I got 3 pages here. I want to cross-examine this main witness on, and the judge says, I've heard enough of this case already. I'm not going to let you cross-examine this witness. But, Judge, I got to cross-examine this witness. This is what the case is about. No, that's it. No more. That's it. Okay. So obviously, not so obviously, I guess I'll ask, do you think in that trial that there's a confrontation problem by the court unduly restricting the right to cross-examine the witness at trial?
I think first there would be an abuse of discretion on the part of the trial court's part. You wouldn't get to the confrontation
okay.
issue.
But assuming that we got to the confrontation, because that's really what I'm interested in, not an abuse of discretion. I'm interested in explaining and defining the contours of the Sixth Amendment right. So assume that's what happened at trial. Would that be unduly restricting the defendant's right to cross-examine the prosecution's witness, which implicates confrontation problems at trial?
It could be.
So if that would be at trial, why isn't it for preliminary hearing testimony that is to be introduced at trial in lieu of the actual testimony of the witness at trial?
Because when the witness is not available for trial, you're confronted with a range of second-best solutions. You can't.
Does that mean the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation then is diluted in that situation?
I wouldn't say it's diluted. I would say that the court has to consider the extent to which that right compels the exclusion of otherwise reliable evidence. And if one comes to the conclusion that this evidence, imperfect though it may be compared to trial testimony has sufficient indicia of reliability, then that is not a violation of the Confrontation Clause.
The hypothetical that I gave you was a hypothetical where the trial court at trial unduly restricted the defendant's right to cross-examination. If the trial court unduly restricts the right of the confrontation rights of the defendant at the preliminary hearing, of course the rights are different there, but for you, I mean, I just don't understand the difference, I guess is what I'm trying to say, when you have the same restriction and now you're offering it for trial for some reason that's okay with the Confrontation Clause, that because we've got some practical problems here, but in the other instance when it's right at trial, that doesn't meet the mandates of the Confrontation Clause.
And the difference is at trial there is no excuse or there's no justification, there's nothing to put in the balance to weigh against the abuse of discretion on the part of the trial court in unduly limiting the right of cross-examination. In this situation, you're confronted with an unavailable witness and a transcript. That transcript is a historical fact. You can't go back and redo it. The question is, given that this is the testimony, do we permit it to come in? Does it bear sufficient indicia of reliability to allow it to come in and let the jury assess it? And the balance that the courts have struck, then yes, if it falls within a firmly rooted hearsay exception, we will let it in absent unusual circumstances. Now, unusual circumstances is something that, you know, it could be an elastic concept, and that has to be defined. The state suggests, or it's the position of the state, that something that is inherent in the preliminary hearing context can't be an unusual circumstance because that will swallow up the rule that's set forth in Bauer that preliminary hearing testimony is generally reliable, generally admissible. But that's not to say that there can't be circumstances in which it would be excluded. In this case, however, there is no Confrontation Clause issue because there's no suggestion that there was anything that Mr. Norman's counsel would have liked to have asked the witness and was prevented from doing that, or that there was any area there which conceivably could have been productive that he was excluded from going into. There was no questions asked to which objections were sustained. There has been no suggestion as to what specifically could have come in that would have had any bearing on the trial or that he was not permitted to get into. The evidence was foundational and, in fact, cumulative, as it turned out. And the cross-examination of Ms. Park was no different from the cross-examination of the other four foundational witnesses at trial who also were there to authenticate documents. So there was no violation of the Confrontation Clause. Even if the Court were somehow to conclude that there was, the error would be harmless as a matter of law, and consequently, the Court of Appeals' decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Ms. Kuchelski?
Briefly, again, at the preliminary hearing, the only issue was plausibility. And because the Confrontation Clause does grant the right to confront a witness with prior inconsistent statements and impeach a witness for bias at the trial, the preliminary hearing testimony does not satisfy the Confrontation Clause. Absent any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kuchelski. Thank you, Mr. Hughes. That concludes our hearing on 013303 CR State v. Norman. The students should remain here, and anyone else who wishes to attend the session with Justice Wilcox. Justice Wilcox will be out shortly. We are in recess until